the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek, and this morning, Katie Mullally and I speak with Carrie Bearden, a professor of psychiatry, biobehavioral science, and psychology at UCLA. She explores the mounting evidence that regular cannabis use predicts an increased risk of schizophrenia and psychotic symptoms among teens. Then surgeon Gabriel Weston takes a scientific look at the wonder, the mystery, and the misconceptions of our anatomy, from guts to genitals, from brain to reproductive organs. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
According to the National Institute of Health, there is now reasonable evidence from longitudinal studies that regular cannabis use predicts an increased risk of schizophrenia and of reporting psychotic symptoms. Now, these days, teens have access to vastly more potent cannabis than their parents had at their age. Parents need to understand the risks, including psychosis. Our next guest, Carrie Bearden, is a professor of psychiatry, biobehavioral sciences, and psychology at the University of California, Los Angeles. She directs a clinical research program focused on early intervention for psychosis spectrum disorders in young people. And she joins us now to discuss her recent article in Scientific American about the link between cannabis and psychosis in teens. Carrie Bearden, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
When I saw this article, I knew I had to talk to you. I knew we had to talk to you because I'm hearing more and more about things like this. And you tend to wonder, is it the chicken or the egg? Is it that adolescents who are already experiencing some sort of psychotic disorder would use cannabis to maybe quell those symptoms? But what you're finding and what the research is showing, that that's not the case. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you summarized the issue really well, Lynn. So in terms of the way that cannabis has changed over time and the way that we think it may be, you know, more likely to influence rates of psychosis. So you're absolutely right. There are sort of competing possibilities about how these two things are linked, because we have these behavioral observations in the environment, right? And, you know, like the chicken or the egg. And so it is certainly true that people with schizophrenia, with a psychotic disorder, are more likely to use substances of all kind, including cannabis. But what the more recent data shows is that long before the onset of any kind of psychotic symptoms, you know, starting as early as age 10 or 12, when some children are starting to use cannabis that at that early of an age, that the earlier the onset of the cannabis use is linked to, you know, is more likely to lead to psychosis later on, and sometimes years later on. So there is this link where, you know, the cannabis use is clearly starting first, and then the psychotic symptoms are emerging later.
And I've heard this among young people who develop a psychosis or bipolar or schizophrenia, is that there is some trigger typically, whether it's like a traumatic event or maybe heavy cannabis use, that's the trigger. But that they would have eventually developed these mental health issues anyway. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's really the big question. And that was certainly our understanding. You know, the way we think about these disorders is there's a big genetic component to schizophrenia, like no question. If you yourself have schizophrenia, if you have an identical twin, your identical twin has a 50% chance of also having schizophrenia. But it's 50%, it's not 100%, right? So there's a lot of other environmental factors that could be getting in there. So one of the questions that's sort of difficult to disentangle is, are people who develop, you know, a psychotic disorder when they're using cannabis, are these people that had a genetic vulnerability? They had this underlying biology that made them vulnerable. And that's definitely, there's definitely some evidence that those people that have this, genetic background, high genetic risk, like a family history, are certainly more likely to develop psychotic disorder when using cannabis. The piece that we're still on the fence about this, and there's, I would say there's competing views about whether cannabis, like modern day cannabis, on its own, without any genetic vulnerability, is causal. Like, will that cause you to develop a psychotic disorder? And so I think basically there's, given the evidence that sort of speaks to that, is that this real strong dose response relationship. So like the more frequent the use and the more potent the THC, the psychoactive component in the cannabis, the higher those things are, the more likely you are to develop a full-blown psychotic disorder when using. And that's really controlling for a lot of the other confounding factors, even things like polygenic risk, which is sort of your genetic background risk for schizophrenia. And I think that the recent research has done a much better job of controlling for some of these other confounds, like socioeconomic status, like smoking, like use of other sorts of substances. And so that's where I think the literature now, the evidence is just a lot more convincing that maybe even without any of these like pre-existing risk factors, it may be possible to tip you over the edge into a full-blown psychotic disorder.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Carrie Bearden. She is a professor of psychiatry, biobehavioral sciences, and psychology at the University of California, and the author of the new article in Scientific American, The Link Between Cannabis and Psychosis in Teens is Real. Well, Carrie, I was reading in your article and other articles you had linked that the levels of THC have increased over 300%. Back in the, what, 90s, it was 2%. THC consisted of 2% of the entire chemical compounds of the cannabis, and now it's up to 28%. That seems to me like it would be an obvious link to this, but what is THC's role, do they think, in this breaking of your brain, if you will?
Yeah, that is a question that we're still trying to really get to the bottom of. But it is a great question, and one thing that I think, as you said, the increasing potency of the cannabis now is something that I don't think people are really aware of in general, because and part, there's this perception that, oh, this is natural, it's a plant, it's going to the ground, but there's a ton of genetic modification that's been done, because this is a very, it's a very profitable industry now. And so so making those products as potent as possible and rapid acting, things like that, I mean, I think those are the things that are very different now from what it used to be. And in terms of our understanding of why that happens, there is preclinical research in animal, like in mouse models, looking at the effects of cannabis on the brain. And so essentially, that THC, it binds to these endocannabinoid receptors in the brain. So our brains have these receptors that are really tuned in to, they really like, they have a strong affinity for that THC molecule. So and those endocannabinoid receptors really change developmentally. And so that's another reason why we think that adolescents may be particularly susceptible to developing psychotic disorder in the use of cannabis.
Have you been able to go back and find any numbers from when, like, we were all teenagers and college? And I don't remember hearing of anybody that had a psychotic break because of smoking pot. Are those kind of numbers available, or is this something that they've just now started to realize that, oh, maybe there's a correlation?
Yeah, some it was actually some of the some groups in the in Europe and in the UK really started sounding the alarm on this with in the legalization, because some of that legalization happened in Europe before it came here. And so there were some groups, mental health experts, that were starting to see these these observations. And so some of those big epidemiologic studies We're going back, you know, just looking, yeah, probably as, and I'm not sure exactly how far back they go, but you can really see like a very striking shift in terms of, you know, the prevalence of cannabis-induced psychosis.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'm looking at an article here that I found in the Journal of Psychiatry, and it talks about a 27-year study with a Swedish cohort that found a very clear relationship between cannabis use and schizophrenia and concluded 13% of cases of schizophrenia could be averted if all cannabis use had been prevented. That's pretty clear cut, and I think it's so interesting in this age that in our country, the use of cannabis is becoming more and more legalized instead of less and less. And there's so much talk about how good it is for you. It's like almost a panacea. I mean, we've had scientists on this show talking about all these benefits also. So what about that?
Absolutely. And right. And I certainly don't mean to demonize cannabis. I think it is interesting because there's, you know, a big sociopolitical context in terms of why, you know, I mean, just in terms of the criminalization of it that, you know, was very detrimental to really to poor people. And so I think that there's some of these, and you know, not to get into that whole area, but I think that, you know, I don't want to say that, oh, actually cannabis is terrible and, you know, there's nothing good, but I do want to just make people aware of this connection that I don't think people have really been aware of until recently. The other thing is that cannabis is really typically this, you know, a ratio, it's a balance of THC, which is the psychoactive component, and cannabidiol, which is believed to have some anxiolytic properties. And so there are some products that are CBD on its own without the THC component. And there's certainly, whether it's actually protective against anxiety or other disorders, I think the jury's still out on that. There are a number of clinical trials that are going on. But yeah, just to be clear, it really is the THC specifically that's the psychoactive component. And that's the part that we think is specifically related to this increased psychosis risk. Because really, the CBD content really hasn't changed much over time. It's that THC, that's the part that really gets you high. And that's the piece that has really changed dramatically. And particularly with some of these, like other means of ingestion with edibles and yeah, and these tinctures and things like that, where you can really get it into your system quite quickly. And so that's another thing that's changed just in terms of mode of ingestion. There's so many ways that you can get cannabis into your system much more quickly than you could from smoking a joint.
Yeah. Well, I know that, you know, you've written this article in Scientific American as a scientist, but also as a parent.
Yeah.
I'm also a parent. My kids are no longer teens, but I think that there's been sort of an attitude among parents that say, like, oh, I'd rather you smoke a little weed than drink. So I wanted to ask you about that, like what you're hearing among parenting groups, and is there this alert that's going on among parents that are saying maybe it's not okay to do this?
Yeah, probably not enough, I think, because I mean the other thing I'll say, like it's not an either or, you know. I mean, certainly there's a lot of legal things that we can do that are not great for us. And so, you know, alcohol, certainly in large quantities, binge drinking in teens, you know, all this, I mean, no question, you know, not to say that one is better. But I think that this is just a connection that people have not really been previously aware of, really due to the, you know, sort of historically thinking that it's a very, you know, it's a mellow drug. So I think that just because, you know, parents may not be aware of just how different the substance is, I think that's where we're really trying to just make people aware, because I do feel like people haven't necessarily consented to the products that they're consuming. And I do in California, at least, there are now some billboards I've seen recently, sort of public service announcements about this increased rate of psychosis associated with cannabis. But that's brand new. And so I was very excited to see that actually out there. But I think a lot of people just, you know, just haven't been made aware. On the cigarettes, you have, you know, these warnings about, so, you know, I think it's similar. I think that there ought to be some warnings about this.
Yeah, my sister was a paramedic and an EMT, and I remember probably 3 or 4 years ago, maybe even longer than that, she said that they had gone out to so many calls where somebody under the age of 25 had had a complete psychotic break, and it was all correlated to the amount of pot they were smoking. And she was just saying, why isn't this getting out there? Well, if you're a parent that has a child that's smoking pot, what are some of the signs for this psychosis that they can watch out for?
Yeah, that's a really important question. So one thing in general to look at for is just increasing social withdrawal, like spending more time alone in your room. And then that could be a lot of things, certainly. I mean, that could be depression, but also something that you should be aware of and, you know, probably talking to them about maybe getting help from, you know, from a clinician, from a counselor. Starting to any kind of unusual behavior, suspiciousness is a big kind of red flag, like starting to become concerned, you know, expressing concerns that maybe people around them are, you know, saying bad things about them, that somebody's out to get them. And then, you know, just sort of other kinds of unusual thoughts or behaviors. Hearing voices is another one where, and a lot of times it may start out not hearing a full-fledged voice, like a full auditory hallucination, but these more minor things like starting to hear like whispers or thinking that, you know, you're seeing things out of the corner of your eye that you didn't notice before, and sort of, and sometimes teens will sort of check in like, hey, did you hear that? Or did you see that? And that's the kind of thing that might not, all that happens to all of us sometimes, but if it's starting to become like increasingly distressing, they're starting to really sort of express concerns about it, that's really where you probably want to, you know, talk to your pediatrician about getting to see a mental health expert.
Once a parent gets their child into a mental health expert, is there a way that these kids can recover, or is this a permanent lifelong disability?
Absolutely. There is a lot of variability. So even for people who develop a full psychotic disorder, there is a huge amount of variability in terms of outcome. And many people do really well on medication. Some people, you know, with sort of continued treatment and sort of under the guidance of their treatment provider, can be on medication and can gradually decrease and maybe go off that medication. For some people, it's a much more sort of brief episode and then things resolve. But for some people, unfortunately, it does, you know, turn into a more chronic condition. Even with a chronic condition, there's still a lot of variability. And one of the most protective factors is family support. So having a supportive family is just incredibly helpful.
We're speaking with Carrie Bearden. She is a professor of psychiatry, biobehavioral sciences, and psychology at UCLA. And we're talking to her about her recent article in Scientific American magazine, The Link Between Cannabis and Psychosis in Teens is Real. This is expanding on Katie's question a little bit. I was reading in your article that looking at adolescents and addiction to cannabis, A, is addiction real? And that also there was this kind of discussion surrounding if you send the child to, you know, like a rehab or something, and you already are seeing these psychotic symptoms and they don't go away, what does that mean?
Yeah, those are great questions. There are, so some rehab facilities are geared to deal with what they call dual diagnosis, you know, psychosis or other mental illness and addiction. Others aren't. And it is sometimes frustrating for parents to find, you know, a treatment facility that's going to be able to work with them with both of those things. We have a program that's for youth that are at risk for psychosis, and they may or may not have, a cannabis issue. And so one of the things that we see is just that if people come in and they are using cannabis very regularly and having these symptoms, like hearing voices, being incredibly suspicious and paranoid, it's really hard to tell whether it's sort of cannabis induced or whether it's, you know, would be happening without the cannabis. And so we do ask people if they can abstain for, a 3-month period and see if those symptoms actually improve. Some people really don't want to do that. And, that's a challenge. But for others, they, sort of recognize that this may be making their symptoms worse, and then they are able to abstain from using. And for some of those folks, their symptoms do actually improve. And so, it really does seem to be like the cannabis was really, that their symptoms were attributable to the cannabis use. But for others, they stop using, and those symptoms are really persistent. And so then for those folks, then we would really initiate, our program, which is really focused on early intervention with psychosocial focus. So family-focused therapy, cognitive behavioral treatment, stress reduction, sleep, reducing substance use, all those things, sort of basic. And then medication is clinically indicated. That's sort of our standard staging of treatment.
Yeah, like maybe never providing the trigger to begin with will help in never having the symptoms of psychosis surface. So many years ago, I think it was like 10 years ago on this show, we interviewed someone who was a psychologist, I believe, and he was doing this research on what makes a psychopath. It was the craziest study, but it ended up that he did this kind of blind survey and he just put a number instead of a name to the survey. And long story short, he finds out that he is a would-be psychopath, but he grew up in with all of the right circumstances and none of the triggers that would trigger his psychopathy. And so we can maybe be predisposed for these things, but if we never trigger them, it never
That's
gets triggered. So,
right. Absolutely. And that's actually a lot of so for the adolescents and young adults that are coming into our program, a lot of them do have some family history of parent or an aunt or, with schizophrenia. And so if those are folks that we really do, just make the case, look, because of your genetics, like you are particularly vulnerable. So this is something that you really should try to stay away from, for people who haven't started using, and really try to work with them in terms of cutting, at least cutting down, if not fully abstaining.
well, Carrie, your article is about teen psychosis, but there were some other great articles that you had linked. And one of them was referring to a study from New Zealand that talked about over the course of 20 years studying people with cannabis use that had an 8-point loss in IQ. And that can be a significant loss, especially if you're of that middle range. And then also the depression that can actually be triggered in young women. Talk about those as well, because that might be another avenue to help convince parents and teens to not use it or stop using it.
Yeah, absolutely. So while cannabis is not, people have the impression, okay, it's not as bad as heroin, for example. It's not as bad as methamphetamine in terms of, its addictive potential, cocaine. Certainly those things are true, but we do see that for people that are using heavily, there is a pretty strong association also with, other kinds of mental health symptoms. And anhedonia is really, this sort of lack of interest or pleasure in doing things, which is, of course, a symptom of depression as well. But really, this just sort of sapping of motivation is something that people do describe who are pretty chronic cannabis users. And of course, people have to have insight into, the fact that the cannabis is actually making things worse and not better, because I think a lot of young people do start using with the idea that it will improve their anxiety. And in the short term, that certainly may be the case. So, that's the other thing that we try to ask people to journal, their mood and across, when they're using, when they're not using. And because sometimes it really does take, that sort of aha moment of, oh wow, actually, every time, like, at 2 days later after I use, like I started feeling really down. And just getting, them to personally make that connection, as opposed to scolding people like, yes, cannabis is bad and you need to stop this immediately.
Carrie, it's time to wrap, but what you were just saying triggered this thought that I have. I'm wondering if there are some brains that do well on cannabis, because we all know those people who smoke or take weed all day long and they're high performers and it just seems to work for their brains.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, it's like, oh, well, I ran across the street without looking, 20 times, and it always works out for me. I mean, so
Good point.
yeah, but it is interesting because I think that, I mean, much like caffeine, for example, I wish I got a strong response to caffeine, but it really doesn't do anything for me. Whereas my husband is just incredibly alert, with like a half a cup of coffee. And so, there are just differences in terms of the way, and I don't think we really don't fully understand this. Like people just metabolize these drugs differently. Maybe the way our, in terms of the particular receptor profiles of our brains are different. And so, yeah, I mean, we certainly can't say for every person that this is going to, lead you down a terrible road. Not at all.
Yeah.
I think we just need people to be aware of the statistics.
Absolutely. Well, you've really helped us understand those statistics as well today. Carrie Bearden is our guest, and she is a professor at UCLA, and she has written an article in a recent issue of Scientific American. You can look it up. It's the link between cannabis and psychosis in teens. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. I think this is a really important interview.
It was wonderful talking with you both. Thank you so much for having me on.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
We must be hardwired somehow to not really ponder the insides of our physical being, our innards. We spend untold hours looking at our skin and maybe what we can just see beneath the surface, like our musculature, but that's really about it. Our next guest takes us much deeper, graphically, you might say. Gabriel Weston is a surgeon and an award-winning writer who explores what it means to live in a body. She explores beyond what you might learn, say, in an anatomy class in medical school. And in her new book, Alive, creates a means through which we can acquire our own mind's eye view of our bodies and just what they do, and how we can find, as Gabriel did, the richness and brevity of existence. Gabriel Weston, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I first have to ask you why we're not calling you Dr. Gabriel Weston and why that's not included on the cover of your book.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I suppose firstly, we have this funny tradition in the UK where if you're a surgeon, you actually get called Miss or Mister, which dates back to the time where surgeons were considered to be very much the lowly physicians who did haircuts and cutting. And so they weren't honored with the sobriquet doctor. And then, sort of, sometime in the last few decades has become something that surgeons slightly lord over physicians, thinking that they're superior. So that's one reason, I guess, is that I never quite think of myself as a doctor. But I think much more than that, I really wanted this book to feel literary. I don't want it to get mistaken for another book of competent science writing, because I really feel that the place I come from is at least as much about philosophy and, in a way, poetry, the poetry of our bodies, as it is about the medicine.
Well, it's interesting that the literary sense that you have put into this book, Alive, gives the reader more of, and I had to use that mind's eye view because we don't think about what goes on inside our bodies, but using the words that you've used in this book makes me think nonstop about it. Like the thing that pops into my mind is when you talked about cutting through a bone and the inside of the bone is succulent. Now, every time I think of the inside of a bone, I can picture succulents. Is that how you initially became interested?
Yes, I see things, I think, in a way that perhaps isn't the way that we're necessarily taught about them traditionally in books at school, at medical school. And I know that my own kids come home with all this stuff about beginner's mind these days and the benefits of thinking almost with a child's mind about things. And I definitely think that as someone who didn't have a science background, I continue to carry with me a sort of sense of being a little bit of an imposter within the world of medicine and surgery. But what that gives me that I think a lot of other medics don't have is a way of looking at the body and a way of looking at medicine that doesn't carry with it all the kind of baggage of assumption and learning that people who perhaps felt that they belonged more in that area have. And I know that when I started out as a medical student, having done an arts degree, when I felt so much like I wanted to disguise the arts part of me, that I was very careful to hide any aspect of myself that might not fit in with other medical students and doctors. But now, you know, decades on as a surgeon, I've come to see this way of looking at the body as distinctive and certainly what makes me feel thrilled about what I discover about the body. And that's really, I guess, what I'm trying to share in my writing.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with surgeon and award-winning writer Gabrielle Weston. She is talking about her new book, Alive, and about what it means to live in a body. One of the things I love about your book is I'm the kind of person that can't even see a needle going into my arm. I'm super, super squeamish. And of course, when I started reading your book, you're talking about how they would peel someone's face off. And at first it was hard to not get the heebies, but I kept reading and it became more of this beautiful narration and this story where you forget, at least I forgot what it was you were actually talking about. How hard was it to create this wonderful narrative and these terms like succulent that aren't typically associated with the human body? How hard was it to create this narrative while keeping it approachable for all of us?
Thank you so much for your comments, first of all. I would say it was the great thrill of the book for me. And I'm so much of a reader and so much of a lover of words. And in a way, the kind of dual challenge of this book was trying to say something new about the body that, as I say, hasn't been described by the very many excellent science writers already out there, but also to use words as sort of more than tools. It's almost as if I'm wanting my thrill in the words to convey to the reader something of my thrill in the body, almost as if the words and the organs share this kind of ability to hold within themselves the enormous and incredible excitement of the human body. And I think that's something, as a doctor, there's an unseemly sort of feeling about being excited by the body, because obviously we usually have sick and injured people in front of us and we need to look earnest and sort of and have furrowed brows. And I've always sort of just found the body so thrilling and so scintillating, and I still do. So I think the words for me became the way, in a way, that I was measuring myself in terms of how much I was conveying what is beautiful about the body. And if I read back on a page and the page of writing seemed dead, then I would think to myself, I'm doing this incredible experience a real disservice. I need to go back. I need to find a way of really sort of bringing the words to life so as to show the body in its liveness.
Well, let's get down to the original, to the organs and the cells. One of the things I am so fascinated with is how we start out of these, we start out as these cells, but as these cells divide and grow, they know what to turn into. How do we even know how the cells that I started with know how to turn into a liver versus a heart versus lungs?
I mean, that's like very, very dainty, intricate science that, to be honest, I wouldn't want to be sort of claiming too much detailed knowledge of. I mean, we know that stem cells, which are the beginning cells of most organs, have this capacity to differentiate into all the different cells in our bodies. And, you know, that's a miraculous process, but a very, very detailed kind of biogenetic process, which I'm happy to say and to kind of, you know, confess right here, I don't think I'm the best person to describe in too much detail.
It's interesting how we can take an organ like a kidney and say, well, it cleans your blood. But it's not until you you wrote, and I had to, as we do, we have to always look up the liter to gallon conversion, but the fact that 200 liters of blood, which is about 52 gallons of blood, passes through the kidney every day, every 24-hour period, paints a much deeper picture of what the kidney does, no kidding, and how hard it has to work, and how many people in this world are on dialysis.
Exactly. So I think, you know, dialysis, it's one of the things. When I was spending a week in the dialysis unit in the UK, one of the things that the woman I spent most of my time with there was really at pains to describe to me was, she said that she felt that people with cancer and people with heart disease just, you know, get so much attention, whereas those in dialysis seem somehow to be forgotten, and somehow it's a little bit of a forgotten organ. I mean, I think within the UK, there are just under 70,000 people who are in what's called established renal failure. And what that means is, you know, kidney failure that can't be cured. So it's kidney failure that will either end up requiring dialysis or will require a kidney transplant. And actually, until I went and spent some time in the dialysis unit, I always assumed that established renal failure could be corrected by a transplant. But I learned there that a transplant is, you know, it's better than dialysis, but it doesn't completely reverse what those patients are having to live with. So I found that sort of that time and studying that organ very interesting, in the sense that, as you say, it is absolutely one of the most vital and crucial organs in the body, but it's one that we don't think about too much, and one that I think people are surprised to hear works as hard as it does, regulating our blood pressure and helping us make vitamin D, as well as the role that we're more familiar with, which is sort of cleaning the blood up. Yes.
Did you find the more that you explored the human body, the more fascinated you are that usually things go right?
I mean, it's such an interesting question. It's such an interesting, I think I felt reminded in multiple ways when I was writing this book, that the underlying impetus of the body is to repair and to grow and to be well. And that, of course, catastrophic things happen that people can't predict and can't be avoided. But generally speaking, it is astonishing how much stress the body can be put under and still recover itself. And I think we probably all know of people in our own lives who have staggered us with their ability to somehow keep coming back, you know, like the cats with nine lives. And so, yes, I think every time I'm in the operating theatre, I have that sense that I'm sort of astonished that the body can cope with the stresses of surgery, even though that surgery is there to be curative or helpful. It's amazing, you know, to see right in front of you, in fact, you're sort of doing it, what you can put a body through and have that body still, you know, functioning really well at the end of it.
Well, I know that so many branches of medicine seem to be siloed, that, you know, there's mental health, there's cardiac, there's, you know, muscular health, but we're all so intertwined. Are these areas, and especially surgeons, starting to understand better the intricacies of the human body and how they all relate to one another?
I really hope so. I mean, my main drive behind this book is a profound sense that as doctors, that we are not making enough connections. I mean, the wonderful English writer E.M. Forster at the beginning of Howard's End says, only connect. And I remember as a teenager thinking, I don't know what he's talking about. And now in every single working day and every day I'm writing about the body, I'm struck by the ways in which we need to be connecting more. So whether that's just doctors and patients kind of being more on a level with each other, which is a big bugbear of mine, or perhaps us opening up medical school to people with more of an arts background like I had. You know, it is possible to have an arts background, and as long as you choose the right specialty in medicine, become a good doctor. But also within the realm of medicine itself, there are so many ways in which we're discovering that parts of our bodies that we previously thought of as just mechanical bits of apparatus are actually connected to each other, to the way we feel, to our emotions. And I'm really excited about that. And I think that's really in some areas, for example, in the gut brain axis, which is written about a lot, that's really coming out a lot now. But I think there's so much more we haven't discovered yet.
Well, I remember a few years ago, and I'm ashamed to admit this, I was in my early 50s, that someone said that the skin is an organ and had never thought of the skin as an organ. It's just this covering for the rest of me. But the more you think about the health of our skin and the basically the importance of it, skin is amazing. And you talk about resiliency and the ability to rebuild, but is it the most resilient organ in our body?
Well, I think what's beautiful about the skin, and you're right, a lot of people don't think of it as an organ, despite the fact that if you unraveled it all on the grass, it would be as big as a parachute. But I think that the thing that's really beautiful about the skin is symbolically, it is the boundary between each one of us and the outside world. So I love the fact that it has that kind of meaning of being that boundary. But in terms of physiology, what the skin does that is so beautiful is not just to act as a boundary against danger from the outside, for example, sunshine or allergens, irritants, chemicals. It's actually a kind of semi-permeable membrane that allows just the right amount of stuff to come in and just the right amount of stuff to go out. And so again, when I was looking at the skin, and I'm a skin surgeon most of the time, so I felt I was very familiar with this organ, but I don't think I realized to what extent it has this kind of beautiful ability to be permeable. And of course, given that when I'm writing, I'm always thinking about metaphorical aspects of truth as well as literal ones, I got very interested in ways that I might be able to look at the skin as something not just physiologically that was a semi-permeable membrane, but as almost like a kind of emotional or even political organ in that sense.
That's pretty wild. I was just thinking about how we refer to people as being thin-skinned or thick-skinned or that. And then the fact that this organ is waterproof. And actually, if it does allow a little water into it, it's going to be healthier.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, isn't it? Just out here, actually, I'm in Melbourne at the moment, and I was actually doing a little bit of work last week for a big beauty brand out here called Mecca. And what they wanted from me was to basically draw or kind of come up with a very simple diagram of the skin describing what skincare products can reach what layers. Because of course, you know, there's a billion sort of multi-billion dollar industry in all this stuff that, you know, people in middle age put on their faces to appear younger. And the fact of the matter is very little of that penetrates the top layer of the skin, which is the epidermis. So it's, I think, one of the things that makes the skin fascinating, but also an area of great potential misunderstanding, is that it's been so co-opted by the beauty industry that, you know, I do feel there's a real need for just very basic kind of clear science, just to maybe protect people a little bit from spending too much money on things that are just going to sit right there on the top of their skin and not do very much.
So true. I've always felt your skin is something that happens from the inside out, really. Yeah, we do spend so much money putting it on the outside. But then things come along like something like collagen that you ingest. That makes sense to me, pragmatic sense, that collagen would help from the inside out.
I think the jury's really still out on that. So I was reading a little bit about that last week, because we know that the layer in the skin of collagen is basically within the dermis. So it's not in that top layer of skin. It's in the layer beneath that. And what, you know, middle-aged women and men the world over are trying to find a way to, you know, to get to that collagen and plump it up and revitalize it. And it's quite difficult. It is possible to do from the outside, but only certain molecules can get through. I mean, again, I think, as I said, I think we're not clear yet about whether ingesting collagen works because, you know, it has to get from the gut to the skin. And how that happens, I don't know, seems also a little mysterious. I definitely favor, as a woman who's married to a somewhat older man, I have a very simple solution to the whole kind of deep wrinkling problem, which is just to stand next to my husband when he's brushing his teeth in the morning. And I immediately feel so much better about myself that I just think I really just need some SPF 50 and I'm good.
Or SPF old man, and then we'll be good to go. Your book is called Alive, but let's talk about what it really means to be dead. Because you talk about heart transplants and liver, you know, organ transplants, and so those people are brain dead, but then there's also times where people's bodies have shut down, but their brains are still functioning. So truly, what is the definition of dead or not alive?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And I you know, think that it is a somewhat culturally determined definition, actually. I mean, it's really interesting how when you're a junior doctor, one of the jobs you spend quite a bit of time doing is certifying patients who have recently died. So you might be in your on-call room and a nurse will call you down and some old man on a ward or someone else has died. And you have to go through a process. It's been a while for me now, but I did hundreds of these death certifications where you had to essentially establish the death of a patient who a nurse had already decided was dead and was dead. And it involved, you know, looking in the eyes and using your stethoscope, and you had to very carefully document that there was no breathing, no heart rate. And I remember when I was a junior doctor thinking, I just can't believe that this is such an elaborate process when this person seems cold and a little blue and there's definitely no pulse. And then I remember having a situation when I was a junior doctor on an ear, nose and throat ward in Guildford. On a different ward, a poor young resident had the terrible humiliation of calling a family in to a patient who was thought to be dead. And by the time the family got there from 2 or 3 hours ago, the woman was sitting up in bed having her breakfast. So, you know, it's not entirely a clear line, I think. Certainly for me, in the writing of this book, it felt very important for me to use death as an idea, as a start point. So in a way, my whole thesis in this book is that the way we're taught anatomy at medical school, and to some extent the way we're taught surgery, is somewhat moribund. So I wanted to begin the book with a post-mortem, not just to say to the reader, here's the body that we're gonna go through organ by organ, but also to kind of say, here's the dead language of science. So in that first chapter, I'm really trying to speak a very prosaic, flat language, almost to give a reader a sense of what it might be like to start at medical school, in order then to have this kind of springboard from which I can start to really enthuse about what the organs are like and what it feels like to hold them and to look at them. So again, always in my writing, I think I'm trying to be in a kind of literal and metaphorical place at the same time. And, you know, the metaphorical one enlivens me definitely as much as the literal.
Well, for the research of this book and at all of your time as a surgeon, is there an organ or a part of the body that maybe you learned more about during this book that you just go, okay, that's really cool?
I absolutely loved learning about the liver. I spent a couple of weeks on a liver unit, actually at the hospital that I had worked at as a medical student. And I found the liver, I mean, of course, we all know, and we know from even Greek mythology and the story of Prometheus, that the liver has this incredible capacity for regeneration. And that was, in a way, my start point of understanding what it might be like to go and spend time with liver patients and think about their disease. But I think the thing that I hadn't anticipated that just astonished me was the extent to which the liver also is an organ where there's all this stuff to do with liver transplants. And so when I was spending that 2 weeks in the liver unit, one of the most fascinating things I got to do was go and attend two liver transplant meetings. And those are the meetings where people are sitting around, doctors, nurses, other experts, deciding which patients might be eligible to have a liver transplant. And so I think the liver had this just, I could have stayed there for weeks and weeks and weeks. I think I just found the sort of tissue level drama of the liver plus the surgical drama, but then the kind of morality of that organ so extraordinary. I kind of could have stayed there forever.
What do you mean by the morality of the organ? Is that when you're talking about, you know, choosing who gets to have a liver transplant and maybe how well they've treated their liver or not?
I think what I found in terms of morality was you have this set of doctors who they're on the ward, they're looking after patients, some of whom have drunk a lot of alcohol in their life, others of whom might just have an autoimmune condition. So every kind of reason for having a liver disorder, you know, some people might say self-inflicted, some people might say that, of course, alcoholism is a disease. But what I witnessed was that on the wards, those doctors cared for all those patients absolutely equally and fastidiously. And yet, when those same doctors were out of their scrubs, in their suits, and sitting around this conference table, making decisions that would ultimately be about whether someone would get a liver or not, they were having to make very dispassionate judgments. So the self-same patients who they were looking after with such incredible compassion and non-judgmentalness, they were then having to make very sort of forensic, quite cold decisions about. And I think I was really struck by the enormous expansiveness of the morality of that. And similarly, the surgeons who I witnessed performing liver transplants were also duty bound to be the ones who would go to a scene in London where they would have to retrieve organs from someone's abdomen that would then be sent out to be plumbed into other people's bodies. So I felt even on a surgical level that even the liver transplant surgeons had this incredible kind of comprehensive duty of being the hero doing the transplant, but also being the doctor that had to perform the very sad, difficult business of organ retrieval. So I don't think I realized before, like, I think the different skills those particular doctors need to have are really deep and really amazing.
Gabrielle Weston is our guest, and her new book is Alive, Our Bodies and the Richness and Brevity of Existence. What a fantastic book. Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining us.
I've loved being here. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.